Wait, wait, stop, that's the one.
Welcome to Zenten Speaks, a show where I make new friends and reconnect with old ones. A show where everyone's stories may inspire you to tell your own story. In this podcast, we encourage everyone to get rid of shame, guilt, fear, doubt, and judgments for themselves and for others, and replace those with love, empathy, compassion, understanding, kindness, and to do your best in everything that you do. In essence, to get rid of things that no longer serve your well-being. To be true to yourself and be honest with others. No need to be politically correct. That's out the window with 2020. Here, we tell the raw, uncensored story, your story. And tell the truth as you see it. Make sure you live your fulfilled life without permission or apologies. So, if you have a juicy, interesting, raw, unapologetic story, and inspiring, please make sure to contact me at zenten21@gmail.com. It is zenten21@gmail.com. Or you can find me on most social media platforms. You know it, the IG, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, OnlyFans. I mean, not really. But yes, OnlyFans. Just kidding. Not. As you may guessed it, my name is Zen, and welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing, man?
Hey, let me get the... Awesome, cool. I see now. Hey, thank you for being on the show.
Hey, thanks for reaching out and putting yourself out there.
Definitely. I appreciate you a lot. And I'm very proud of you. I see what you're doing. And I'm so excited to ask you questions.
Hey, thank you.
Yeah, totally. All right. Today we have a guest. Our guest today is Tyler Howell. And Tyler and I met online on Facebook. We're not sure exactly which page it was, if it were either was a sobriety page or a podcast page, but we are here today talking to you, Tyler and you. So I was compelled to hear more of Tyler's story because he is here to tell it. And when I read it through the DM, I was like, I got to have him on the show because it's very inspiring. So as you may know by now that this show is about sharing our stories of shame, guilt, and fear and judgment for ourselves and how we are working on getting rid of these things that no longer serves for our well-being. So Tyler's website is felonexperience.net, and I will put that on the description below as well as his LinkedIn that he sent me. And welcome, Tyler, to the show. Thank you for being here. I appreciate you.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Definitely. So tell us about who you are and what brings you joy.
Who I am just a normal guy with struggles and demons, just like everybody else. And my struggle, my demon was addiction, which stemmed from abandonment and other childhood traumas through being taken from my birth mom. And then going to the foster system, getting adopted, stuff that, you know, resulted in me getting taken away. And so who I am today is actually a reflection of those struggles and those demons that I've had to face and overcome. So that's who I am, because without those, I wouldn't be who or where I'm at today. And today, after doing 7+ years in federal state prison because of my addiction, I'm in college and I'm contributing to the life experiences that kind of, you know, put me, you know, through prison and stuff like that to help the next, you know, man or woman. So like I was saying, without my demons or my struggles, I wouldn't have purpose or direction today. So
And doing the work you currently do now, is that your primary joy or do you have other joys in your life?
I'm going to college for biology. Addiction has genetic exhibitions as well. And now we have CRISPR-Cas9 and various new medical sciences coming out that now allow us, what was once set in stone is no longer set in stone. And so now the toolbox has been opened. And so because of my struggles with addiction, that's one of my passions. And due to the justice system and the way that it kept, I feel, setting me up to keep coming back, the way it exploited me, I have a passion for justice reform because I have experienced literally many, many things that millions of other Americans today experience. And that's part of the reason why they struggle to excel or to, you know, move past those demons and struggles. And not every one of us is equipped as maybe, say, another man is. So the ones of us that are equipped, it's up to us to pave the path for the next man and do what we can. So the struggles and the demons that we faced and had to overcome are a little bit easier for the next man. And so justice reform and science are my passions and my joys.
Wow. Please tell us more about the justice reform stuff, because I never went through any of this stuff and I've learned more about it probably over 4 years ago when Kim Kardashian's and President Trump was doing their things. And that's when, of course, I know like in life, there's so many injustices, but not until then I was learning more in depth about it. So, but since you experienced it firsthand, please tell us more what you've experienced and what is your drive to change those things and what are the process that you're taking to hopefully change them?
Well, my experiences stem from, you know, my foundation of what brought me into the justice system was addiction. And throughout federal prison, state prison, county systems, I was never given any tools. I was never given any programs. I was denied programs while a small population was allowed these programs. And now that I have, you know, I did my last sentence, I intentionally, I literally begged for a termination because I understood that the probation and parole system, they thrive off of non-criminal stipulations that they violate people for. And so I kept coming back for various all sorts of reasons. And the first step was overcoming and escaping that parole probation. And I haven't been back since. I don't know if that specifically answers your question, but inside those walls, the environment, the more you understand about human nature, habits, our mentalities, how we absorb from around us, you'll wonder how anybody even makes it from those years to release and then transitions without any help, any resources. They release you to the streets. They do all sorts of things that put you in a really, really bad spot that almost based off human nature forces you to go back to what you know, because you only know what you know. And when you release, that's the same as what you knew when you came in. So when you're, you know, have housing, access to employment, you know, you're on the streets living in a homeless shelter, you've been living in a toxic environment where the thoughts, ideas, mentalities have been basically infiltrating your mind for years. It's a very, very, very hard trajectory to deter from. And so everything I'm doing today is just basically taking my experience, my insight, maybe combining it with some science, you know what I mean? Obviously some justice reform, because there's, you know, nature and nurture. If you want to use society as a form of nurture, the policies and legislations that, you know, restrict or allow certain people from doing certain things, it's a part of that nurture. And we're not being nurtured into, you know, new trajectories and new ideas, new mentalities. We're being kept in the same spot we were in when we came in. And that's why recidivism, which is the rate of reoffense, is 77% of people reoffend within 5 years. And that is very strategically, done.
Why do you say that? Like, what's the tangible, as people say now, facts? Like, why do you say that? Or your experience?
So a good majority of populations, if you heard of solitary confinement, so like my last year was 3.5 years. My last bid was 3.5 years. My first year was 23-hour day lockdown. So I came out of my cell for 1 hour a day for a year. My second year, I came out for 3 hours a day. In my last year and a half, I was in population. And you would think as you get closer in a population that you'd have access to these programs, these resources, these things that these jails and prisons are telling the public that they have, but you actually don't. You actually don't have access to it. And now that I've been networking and getting involved in justice reform, I understand that that's actually a tactic used. That's a strategically implemented tactic to appease social outcry, social pressure, whatever it is. But unless you are connected behind the bars, you don't understand that, you know, there might be 20,000 in this prison. This program only offers 300, you know, inmates access. But out of that 300 inmates, only 4,000 were actually in that pool to be part of that 300. And so it goes across the board. And that's kind of what I'm currently getting involved in. I can go more into that, assuming I'm answering your questions right. But
yeah, it's beautiful. I don't know any of this stuff, so yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
So in 1994, even though less than 1% of people incarcerated, Americans that are incarcerated, used Pell Grant funding for education, they banned this demographic from access. They've done a lot of studies. So with just a 2-year degree, your chance of recidivating, so reoffending, is decreased by 48% just with a 2-year degree. And it's funny how they've intentionally barred this demographic from access to this resource. So 1994, they banned this demographic from access to the Pell Grant funding. Just last year in December, they have now allowed access to this funding for people incarcerated. Well, as I was saying before, just because something's available doesn't mean it's accessible. And so what we see is if you're like maximum, medium, or in lots of different parts of jails and prison systems, they use security as a reason to prevent these Americans from access to life skill enhancing programs, to education and stuff like that. So now that this money, this is my current project, now this money is available, how do we actually make it accessible? What are the barriers? What are the steps? And then obviously it's not going to be a simple problem, but over time we can do anything.
So who are they?
In reference to the political actors and legislators who create the resources and allow the funding, or the populations that these are meant to improve the lives of?
The former, because you're mentioning they, because it's tough. So I don't remember the quote exactly of MLK, but he mentioned something like a riot is basically, as we know, like if you poke an animal enough and the animal will growl and basically bite back. So I've noticed when people are fed up, there is, I don't know if you watched a speech from, was it Kevin Noah or somebody, Noah? He mentioned, he was just saying that when people are fed up, the government or people on top want people to still be polite, even when they're angry. You probably had experienced that even in your life. I had experienced it when someone's poking you so much. And then once you blow up, they're like, see, why are you angry? And they like victim blaming, they turn it around. And then because you're ashamed, and then you go like, okay, I'm going to be polite about it. But this is like something that's really terrible in life. How they are putting people in jail and they're not even reforming anybody. They're hoping you come back, and how they're making money. When you go to jail, there's this company that makes money from it. And they even have literally slave labor because you're making like cents of a dollar to do things. And And we know that we, the people, can change it, but somehow it feels like we are, even me, I'm speaking to the choir, like, I guess because it's not, I never experienced those things. So sometimes when you experience it, you're more of a voice. And since I haven't experienced it, of course, I'm against the, how you call it? The, how the government or whoever is behaving and doing things to people who's been in jail or prison. But I feel like kind of like there's so much battles to fight. And sometimes when you experience something, the battle is more strong and you is more personal. And when you have it, you just have an opinion about it without doing the battle. And there's so much you can do, but it feels like it needs to end like already. And so, and it's great that you're doing the work that you're doing and because you experienced it and it's very personal to you. But I feel like I was looking at the number, let me see here if I have it. There's like about over 300 million people living in the United States.
330 million.
Yeah. And at least there's like, there's 58 million use tobacco. Well, you don't go to jail for that, but at least like other addictions, there is 31 million people with addiction. It's probably a lot of them has gone to jail for it. And so, I mean, if all these people, not all, but like at least a big chunk of them get, become that animal that is poked and go on the street and be like, we're going to change this, like no more politeness, no more Mr. Nice Guy, because we need a change. I think they'll be forced to change. Because as you notice, there's other riots or protests for other things like race or other, like Women's March, but there isn't for other things that is, in my opinion, on a bigger scale, like addiction or being put in prison. Because when you put in prison, there's multitude of reasons, so that's like a bigger issue than these other issues that are underneath. What do you think?
Well, no, you're right, because at the end of the day, as humans, we only have the capacity to care about so much. We only have the capacity for so much. So everybody can't be passionate about everything. And when I was in Washington, D.C. this last summer doing my internship for a nonprofit and taking a government course, I learned about a term called political hobbyism.
And say that again.
Political hobbyism. So just like we watch the sports, you know, we watch sports on TV, we're not the ref, we're not the coach, we're not the players. We have opinions, we have views, we have emotions associated with it, but we're not actually involved in anything that affects anything on that field. And so with politics, just like with homelessness, justice reform, women's rights, whatever it is, it's become normalized to basically treat politics and our legislations and our policies like we do a sports team. We just watch, we have opinions, but we don't have the energy per se to actually take action and contribute towards that. And the biggest fallacy of politics is, oh, I voted for the president, so I have contributed to, you know, social change. And we've seen what happens just because you vote for somebody doesn't actually mean anything's going to happen for anything.
And they're complicit for four years waiting for the next election. Right.
Yep. But we continue to do it. But that's part of why things are the way that they are. But that's why passion is so powerful, because it brings people that maybe normally wouldn't have, you know, contributed or taken action. It brings them onto the playing field. And now they're on the court. You know what I mean? Now they're, you know, lobbying. They're doing this, this, and this. I mean, we have GeoCare and Core Civic. They run private prisons. They lobby millions of dollars for mass incarceration policies. Geo Group is a publicly traded stock that's value literally reflects the monetization of human beings. And that's Americans and ICE detainees. And the only way for them to make a profit off a fixed amount of number per head is to cut corners, whatever it is that they have to do, these unethical things that the state and feds have been like, you know what, we don't want to do this. We don't want to deal with this. But if they do it, we're not at fault. So we'll contract them. We'll let them deal with it. We'll let them take the shortcuts. We'll let them, you know, do that. And so now they've been monetized. So conflict of interest. So now that these beds being full, like you said before, all these businesses that are profiting through the prison systems, the jail systems, like there's so much money being made off these people that the depth of corruption, as we know, money corrupts pretty much, can corrupt anything, that the system's just so corrupted, the depth of it. I mean, if you know the history, so 13th Amendment, they left the clause for criminal activity. Well, then we went to convict leasing. They did that for a long time. So they left a loophole so they could still, you know, have their old ideas and thoughts. And this was their way around it. This is how they appease social pressure and social movements, but they were still doing the same thing in just a different fashion. And then once they outlawed convict leasing, you know, that's when we saw our prison, like from there on, basically the foundation of our prison system is built on exploiting people, and it has evolved into, instead of just exploiting one group of people, now it's communities, social undesirables, people with addiction, people who are in communities, you know, maybe from the integration from then. So it's funny how the people with money, they come from certain communities. So there's loopholes for those communities.
Yeah.
The poor communities, they don't have the same loopholes. That's how they target different communities, by leaving the loopholes for money that reflects like a geographical community. Because like when you're born, they already have data on you based on where you were born, how long you're going to live, how much money you're going to make. Then they kick that much money into the economy to compensate for your life. You know what I mean? So there's just so much, like, just a foundation is just so questionable. It's so questionable.
And there is, I feel that, you know, just like divide and conquer. If you go into jail or prison, for whatever reason, it could be in New York City, you could, your bladder could explode and you pee on the corner just to relieve yourself. And then you can be labeled and go to jail as a sex offender. Yeah, and someone can just read that and thinking you molested a child or did something horrendous, but you did not. So there is this divide and conquer thing where, because of that stigma of like, you went to jail or you're a bad person. So someone who hasn't gone to jail, who doesn't understand these things, gonna be like, oh, you're a bad person, and then treat you as, without knowing your story. Mm-hmm. And I feel like this is why, maybe the reason why the vast majority who hasn't gone to jail, just, it's not their passion, they don't care for it. And I do understand with the passion part. So this is why anyone who's gone through it and who has a passion, if they maybe, and I know some people are doing it because there are some programs in New York City, I forget what it's called, but there is this guy who created a program for people to hire convicts because they want to go back to society and no one would give them rent and they can't go shelter because they're men and there's all these issues. And what are you going to do? Like you say, set up for failure, you're going to go back. So the guy created this program called, I think it's called Willing, Able or something, where you give them jobs and for 1 year, they give them shelter at least. So you have 1 year to like get yourself together and hopefully, you know, and there's other jobs where people can get jobs without them asking for these things, but it's tough out there. So I feel like if people who's gone to the system get together and create as much as, what's that thing called? As much as a voice as the BLM or other groups have done, things will change. Like look at the Women's March. Like in our current history, that was like one of the biggest, well, last 4 years, biggest march. And why can't we march for people who've gone to jail, especially innocent, or even if you weren't innocent, you did your time and you won't come back to society. Like, why can't we do these march for that? Kind of a thing. And so actually, if there's a march, I will go for that, because I don't go to many marches, but for that, and I haven't, and it's not even my thing, I never gone to it, but I feel, I know it's wrong, and I do feel like it's wrong, and it's like people can change or grow, and I feel like we need to give people chances and not discard them like a dirty tissue. And it's very wrong.
Well, and you made a good point earlier too. When you brought up Kim Kardashian and that project she did, well, someone that I met when I went to DC is Haleem Flowers, and he was actually on that documentary with her and involved in all that. And he got out. So at age 17 or 16, he was given a life sentence for being accessory to a murder. It's funny because the dude who actually did it got out before he did. He got life, funny story, but he got out under ERA. Wow. So these are the social little changes, the baby steps. So due to science now, can prove that the prefrontal cortex, which is that's for decision making and logic, in the average male, it's not developed until the age of 25. So our decision making, yes, based on biology, it's interfered with. It's faulty. And so now people who have, Americans who have gotten life sentences or long extended sentences that were given before the age of 25 are now given an avenue, at least in Washington, D.C., to get out of prison. And Haleem, he got out under that. And he literally illustrates that people change. What you did in your youth it's a big part of the community that you were raised in.
Yeah.
Like, he was misdirected and misguided. And that's the problem too, is the people, the social undesirables that are being filtered into the system because they come from low money, poor communities, you know what I mean? Just broken communities and stuff like that. Like, they're not given the actual chance, and nor do they have the biology and the neurology to actually perform, you know, to their potential. And with redirection, with options, with opportunity, people change. And so there's a lot of good stuff and good movements going on. There's a lot of initiatives. And it's such a deep-rooted issue on so many fronts. There's so much money in it that we can't take it. We can't fix it all at once. It's getting incremental. I think the biggest changes happen incrementally because as human nature, we don't like dramatic changes to begin with. You know what I mean? So, I mean, but like when you brought up the Kim Kardashian thing, like, I love that because I invited Haleem. So in April, I am organizing my first ever political event. It's a roundtable and a panel in Washington, D.C. I intern for the Ronald Reagan Institute and Presidential Library. And so this is going to be my first crack into justice reform. And we're bringing together various executive directors of multiple organizations. We're bringing department heads from like UC Irvine, Arizona State University, and then we're bringing like senators who are involved in this. And we're trying to get more powerhouse influencers. So people, maybe it's like the Koch brothers, Charles Koch. We're gonna try and bring this group of people together to tackle these issues and bring diversity really to the forefront of solving problems, especially people that have been through it, people that have been through it, but they have the political reach to actually get these changes and these gears and these balls rolling and going.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we can't change the world. No one man can change the world, but we can all try to do these little things to get something going and accumulatively. And then once we start coming together, like you were saying, like, five stakes are harder to break than one. I think that kind of reflects itself too in, you know, social movements and social culture progression.
Yeah, I do agree, because that's, as I noticed, that's how life works. However, I feel that it also doesn't have to be that way, where we need to do baby steps when we know something is wrong. Like, when we see it's wrong. Example, I don't know how long these other things took for them to be in the law or be persecuted. But when it comes to example, just making like a big example here, like rape toward anybody or child molestation toward children, and that's like rape too, and or murder. Like, I don't know the history of these things where people say, oh, let's do baby steps, but they probably go like, okay, this is totally wrong. Let's just like tackle it and get rid of it, period. And so I feel like the justice system is like so wrong that we don't need baby steps. We need to be like, okay, these are the lists that are wrong. Let's tackle them now. And of course, who is in charge of these things are people who are on top with the power and with the money. But we all know that I'm all for self-accountability. We are the ones giving them that power because we're not taking it away from them, even by force. And even if you're looking at history in the last, it's probably still happening around the world, but in the, let's say the major history as we know, like when the government in Russia was toppled over, or even in Korea or in France and things like that, people are like fuck the baby steps, we're over this, let's get rid of that, let's change something because it's not working. And of course something else that was like probably as bad rose up, but still they got rid of something that was like not working. And if we, just like in our lives or even in your life, you went through certain things, and of course definitely the way to eat an elephant is little by little, and you did your baby steps. But at some point, and I know also in my life, you probably woke up and be like, I am effing done with this. And you were like, it was like, it felt here, like I'm done. Like you did your little steps to get there, but there is that revoltness you had in yourself and you're like, I am done. And then based on that decision, you did your other steps. And I feel like, well, this is a call to action to anyone who's been in jail or prison. And if you're out there and you see all the things that you didn't like and you think that we need reform from, you need to do it. And you can rally those who haven't been in jail and prison to help you out as allies, because we need everyone's hands to do all this stuff, because we need that human empathy and compassion. And as you mentioned, with change, if our bodies change every 7 years and if our mentalness changed 3 to 5 years, because I wasn't who I was, like not even like 2019, yeah. 2020 changed me like 5 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, mentally, 5 years. So, and when it comes to change and giving chances, I feel that if you are, okay, so like if they say, okay, you're getting out and you are giving resources, opportunities, and I want to say force, but in a sense, kind of like inspire and push someone to do the change and get with them to do something. And if they actually refuse like all the resources that you are capable to give them and willing, and you want them to change and be a better person in society, whatever, I would say, okay, they made their decision to be where they're at that moment in time in their mind, fine. But if you're not giving, you taking away resources, you're not giving opportunities or resources, and you're gonna be like, do find your own self out there, that's totally wrong. Like,
well, no, you're 100% right. I mean, like, so this is one of my favorite presentations of the obvious targeting of a demographic. Like, what keeps you alive? The first thing for me that comes to my mind is employment. That's income. It's how I pay my bills, pay my electricity, wear clothes, get my car, get my gas. So you got employment, and then you got housing. Your housing's what protects you. It's your safe zone. It's yep. your grounding point for your life. It's a place to work on things, to just be safe and productive, in a sense, mentally, and be stable. Well, it's no surprise that these are the two targeted zones of yes. anybody who has been inside a prison.
Yes.
We're limiting where you can live. We're limiting the options, the geographical locations, mm-hmm. and then employment. When I'm in college, I literally couldn't get a job at Lowe's, even though it'd been 6.5 years since my last felony. I got denied a job at Lowe's to sell lumber. So you're telling me that I can't sell lumber because 6.5 years ago, I made some mistakes, you know what I mean? And so I ended up working at a gas station for $11 an hour. So I had to take a dramatical pay cut just to pursue my education and have, you know, an income. And so no wonder it's hard for people to find footing and traction and to find that, you know, just even that like hope for themselves. She's like, man, I can't work at Walmart. Walmart won't even hire me. You know what I mean? Like, I got to do construction, which means I can't do school. I can't do these other things that are going to educate me or progress me. So it's almost like they direct you to areas to deter you from actually excelling internally, you know, seeking education and knowledge like that. Like, it's just so wrong. I mean, it's so obvious. You know, when I was in DC, so the nonprofit I went and interned for was Voices for Second Chance, great organization. Well, DC's a mess. So when these returning citizens get released out of prison, they're literally given nothing. So one of our outreaches is we go to Baltimore and we go to the VOA, which my belief in the VOA being Christian based and everything is I do not respect anything that they're doing because I've seen what they're actually doing that the normal everyday people don't see. And they don't equip anybody with anything, like period, like housing, these people in the streets. We've got a lot of the homeless population out there just got out of prison. They're not given anything. Like, no wonder they come back. Like, it's so targeted. It's so obvious. 93% of incarcerated adults in Washington, D.C. are African-American. 100% of the juveniles are African-American. And so I think our Capitol really emphasizes the root and where all this started at. And until that changes, I mean, it's going to be a lot harder to change the rest because that's a reflection of, you know, the history and, you know, the foundation of our justice system. It was created the way it is to target certain people. And until that's fixed, I mean, it's going to be harder to fix the other stuff because it's so ingrained in everything our justice system stands for.
Right. And it is up to us, the people that's have our perceived freedom outside the jail, to do something about it, definitely. And this conversation is giving me a drive, and I would definitely love to hear more later on in your life, whatever you're doing, and if you're doing something, well, because of travel restriction, but like in the future or whatever, I would love to get more into servicing others, especially. Because I feel like we do not need to have an experience into something to care for it. Because especially as of 2020, with all the things that was happening, I was noticing that. And I was just like, and I had to go within myself and be like, how many things that I've ignored and didn't care about because I had the privilege that it never happened to me. And I didn't had the privilege to not care about it and how someone else probably needed help. And so well, it also helped me doing the podcast to reach out to and talk to so many different people in different experiences. And so I guess that's one way to bring out the word, but I've also started because I don't work, I'm not vaccinated, so I cannot do so much work. So instead of sitting at home, if I'm not doing this or editing videos or working on my other art, I go out there and volunteer in shelters and things like that, because I'm like, it's servicing in others that we find joy or other things and doing things to our community. Because one thing that I don't like being the complainer and the person with opinions and sitting on my ass and being a keyboard warrior about stuff. Like, I don't like that. If I'm going to complain about something, no, there is a solution coming in, or I want to find a solution. That's the
I love that. I love that. That's the mentality. You got to spread that mentality right there.
Yeah. And I don't need to experience something to know it's wrong, that people are being taken advantage of. That's totally terrible. So tell us about your childhood, and if you can do a timeline in years for me.
So my childhood, well, this is my birth mom was 13 when she had me. My birth dad was her stepdad. After she had me, her mom, blamed her for what happened, even though she brought the predator into the house that resulted in this and didn't listen to my mom. So the next, you know, 4 or 5 years as she, you know, tried to raise me, she just repeated the same cycle, being abused by older dudes in order to survive, because that's all she knew because of her mom. And eventually she had another kid at age 15, 16. Well, my half sister, my actually my my absolutely half sister, my you know birth half sister died of sudden infant death syndrome. They suspected some other things, but basically they deemed that a 13-year-old is not equipped, especially with the history that she had, to raise a child. So DCFS took me away. I was only in the foster system for like a year, year and a half. And then I was adopted. And that right there through my life and my experience highlights the impact that the first 4 years have, because I got adopted into a great, great family, religiously sound. And that's the fundamentals of family, the principles. They were LDS. To a great family, great structure, and nothing they did could erase what had happened before. And the neurological pathways that had developed in my mind, the defense mechanisms that had developed in my mind due to my previous life experiences. And so that was the shaky part of my childhood. And even though I don't remember any of it, best believe it's exhibited itself in my life. It's the contrast. It's just nuts. So, I mean, that's the basis of my childhood. When I was adopted, great family, like I was loved for, given everything I needed, you know, they tried their hardest. I mean, they made decisions that I don't agree with, but in the moment, that's the best that they could do. They didn't know what to do. I've exposed them to the side of the world they didn't even know existed. You know what I mean? And so post-adoption, like great childhood, I was troubled. So I got in trouble about 12 when my grandpa died. I would say that the abandonment traumas from my childhood were agitated in that experience, because I'm in this religious family and God-fearing, God-loving. And my grandpa, I watched him deteriorate. I literally watched him deteriorate from, was it esophagus cancer? And I was just so confused on everything I was told, like, why would this happen? So I started rebelling against I stopped going to church and I went and sought out drugs. And it was just a downhill spiral from there. And then at 15, my parents sent me away to a group home. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. We go back to this abandonment. Not only did they send me away once, they sent me away twice. So, I mean, just the stuff that before they had adopted me, those traumas were agitated through, you know, experiences later on in life. And I started getting into the heavier drugs. So that was from 15 to 17. And then about 18, 19 is when I started getting to drugs. As a means of coping with just life in general. Like, it's crazy how, even though I wasn't raised by my birth mom to my recollection, I turned out just like her in a sense. It's nuts. And this is why I'm taking genetics as my approach to solving social issues, including addiction. And that's when my criminal career started. I started using meth, became an IV user. It was the worst thing in my life. Battled that demon from 19 to basically 24 years old. Because I was in prison when I turned 25. And it's funny, I got out when I was 27, almost 28, but something had changed. So it's funny, the under era, the prefrontal cortex, like literally things clicked in my brain that literally were against me up until that point. And that's when things changed. And I started, you know, learning from my actions. I feel like my biology, my neurology was against me. And it's not that I couldn't. It's just that it was a lot harder than it naturally will be. Give me a few more years till I'm developed. But there's a kind of brief, quick timeline. I don't know if that's what you were asking.
So actually, later on, I was going to ask you if you had any ties to the LDS, because you said Utah. So I had that question, so you already answered it. But so that means you did not go to missionaries since they sent you away?
Well, that was 15 to 17. When you would go on a mission, I was actually fighting my first criminal case when I was 19. So that was my federal gun case, which wasn't even my gun, but I was involved in all of it. So I can't complain. Yeah. I made those decisions. That's why who you who you associate yourself with definitely plays a role in what happens later. Because regardless about whether that was my gun or not,
yeah,
I put myself there. You know what I mean? I'll pay the consequences for it. You know what I mean? You gotta learn some lessons the hard way.
You know, that's beautiful that you say that with a smile, and that's one of my motto in my life. I am about self-accountability and responsibility, and I do not blame anything or anyone outside of myself. Even I believe that even not making a choice is a choice. When people say I don't have a choice. And unfortunately, as human beings, life is a paradox. Like, it's your life and you do and you don't. You could be fucked, so you just gotta do. And if you get fucked, you just gotta, okay, I gotta do more to do what I need to do, because it's all about survival. And of course, and that's great that you brought that up. Like, it's not your gun and people you were with. And I think, like, some other people who are stuck in the realm of victimizing themselves, then they would be missing the lesson or how they can do better. And then they're still hanging out with those associations because they feel like, if someone do something, it's not my thing. So, and looking back, I used to hang out with a lot of people. I wanted to be, you know, when they say be like Jesus. So hanging out with the prostitutes and the thieves and the tax collectors and all this stuff. But I also made sure that I didn't do any of the stuff that they did because it was their lives. But I could hang out with them in a sense of, like, loving them and see them as human beings and validate their story and validate them as a being. And I think one needs to have wisdom. And that's when I growing up, one of my prayers I also often prayed is saying, God, I want to be like Solomon, to have wisdom. Because I feel like if you have wisdom, then you have the wisdom to make good choices. So therefore, you don't need to be like, you don't need to get specific, because wisdom is the foundation of, like, everything else you could gain. And so I didn't get any of those situations because I applied the wisdom part. And I'm so grateful too, when, if I had friends who were doing things that I didn't feel like was good, I would say, whatever you're doing, whatever, I'll be back, or let me do my thing and whatever. And some of them did not like that, of course, but the ones who accepted my own decision as a human being, they got into trouble, but I wasn't there. And because I still accepted them as them being doing themselves, but I don't need to be part of it, because your action is your own karma and I don't need to be part of that. And I think that's a thing that people can maybe accept in life, that you can have whoever is your friend. Even having, I've had roommates almost all my life. I often tell them when they move in, because I'm in charge of the house, I often tell them, I will not ever judge you anything you do. However, whatever you do, do not make it my problem. Your problem is yours alone. If you're gonna try to make your problem mine, we're gonna have an issue. And yeah, that's the only time I have issues with people. So that's great. You take self responsibility.
Yeah. No, 100%. I totally agree.
Yeah. So I was curious with the, it seems like you did LDS, LDS, right?
Yeah. Latter-day Saints.
Yeah. So I have a curious question for you, because I've noticed on your page, you mentioned God. So I often would ask people, so is it God that will fix it for you, or is it you? Because I grew up Jehovah's Witness, kind of like similar to LDS. I've seen some similarities. And side notes, I did study with LDS this year and last year, so I can learn and know about it. And I've noticed a lot of similarities. I am all about self, in a sense, like, and as LDS teach, to have a self, what's that thing called? Like a willing thing. You guys have a word for it. I forget what word that is. But yeah, I'm all about making my own choices and have repercussions, like, of myself, because I did it. And so I've noticed a lot of people, when something good happens in their lives, they say, they praise God. They say it was God. But then when they do things that didn't go well in their lives, they blame themselves. Actually, not many people blame themselves, but most people blame the devil, which is like something outside of themselves still, not taking self-accountability. And some people, not a lot of people would, then people who do bad things will blame themselves for the bad stuff. But when they do good, they give that praise to God. Can you, if that relates, can you help me understand that mindset?
Oh, 100%. I'm not religious. I'm spiritual. Having a upbringing that was religious. And then now in college, I studied sociology of religion because things just didn't feel right. And now I know why things didn't feel right, you know, for organized religion, just for me. And part of what fed my addiction is like ego, pride, selfishness, stuff like that. Having been able to experience spirituality separate from man's organized religion, and history shows this, we can go as far back as Josephus. You know what I mean? We can go all the way back. I now am able to, like you say it's God, but like, it's like God is within us. I don't know how to explain that. The mental redirection of having a relationship with something that is transcendent beyond myself, it creates a wedge in my worst, my worst exhibited behaviors based off human nature. For me, those are dangerous mindsets, thoughts, and directions. And having found God separate from man has given me a relationship and the ability to redirect my mind in ways that I was never able to before until I could separate the two. It's like once you've been to hell, like, you know, I don't need some organization to say, do this and this, this, and this. I've been there.
Yes.
And for every action, there's an equal opposite. So if there's hell, whether this is symbolic or this is metaphorical, there is a head, there are opposites. And I've walked this road and I know what not doing these mental redirections and taking my thoughts captive and stuff like that. I know what that does to me. So now that I can separate the two from man's world order to spirituality, I have now been able to logically, so in a way that makes sense based on, you know, what I feel, my soul, my heart, my mind, I've been able to take those concepts to a whole new level. And I don't know if that explained it right, because that's how I'm thinking it. And sometimes how we think things doesn't necessarily make sense to someone else, but
right. Yeah.
I mean, it might surprise, because I was so against the concept of God, the idea of God, the idea of anything beyond myself. Anything transcendent above me, because of my experiences as under organized religion, it just didn't click with me. But then I went to recovery, which is why being an addict, because that history is a part of me. Without my addiction, I wouldn't be who I am today. I wouldn't have been forced. So when they talk about blaming God for the good and the bad, like, we need trials to grow. That's human nature. We have to touch the hot stove. We have to fall. We have to slip. That's how we learn. That's just how we are wired. You know what I mean? And so I just might, the concept behind spirituality, God, you know, and then you throw in separately religion. It finally has clicked through my life experiences. And like, if someone asked me, do you regret anything? Would you go back in time? No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't have the passion, the trajectory, the ideas. You know what I mean? Like, I wouldn't have that fire. You know what I mean? Right. So I'm thankful for my addiction. Because now that I'm out of the darkness, I can go back in and help the next man. You know what I mean? Like, that's my purpose now. You know what I mean? In whatever forms or fashion that might be, I now have purpose. And so even if I had never had addiction, gone on a mission, done all this, like, how would I have felt about my life? Like, how would I value my life? Because I value, especially with prison, I mean, I value things. You know what I mean? Like, I value so much. And without these life experiences, I wouldn't feel this way. And so you become grateful. You become grateful for the trials and struggles, the hells that you've had to walk through. Because without those, like, There's none of that light, that fire, that soul feeling, that void that I had. Like, I had to feel that with, and now I do. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it's an interesting having from here to here to here. And then when I study sociology of religion, I kind of understand more about the actual statistics. So I'm like, if you were raised under this, what are your chances of staying with it? Like, you have this stuff down to a science. Like, it's man's world or organized religion, but it's like with a t-shirt though. You can't sell the same colored t-shirt and style to everybody. You need different styles, different colors. That's mm-hmm. why I accept all religions, because they have the same principles, foundations, family, do good, think good, try to be better. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it's all the same. It's all the same foundational principles of living a good life and not negatively impacting those around you. You know what I mean? And so, like, I don't associate with them, but I understand the need for them.
Yeah.
You know, as a shell for spirituality and God. Some people need direction. They need to be told, do this, 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 and this. This is what you have to do. Some people don't. You know what I mean? It's just different methods, styles, getting the same destination for more than one way to skin a cat. And that's kind of how I feel about, you know, religion, you know, separate from spirituality.